following podcast is brought to you exclusively by the R&R Podcast Network. Welcome to RTW Rewind. Red Rob will take you on a journey through time to relive some of the greatest moments, matches, and personalities from the sport of professional wrestling. Now, here's your host of the show, Red Rob, Rob Francois.
Hey guys, welcome back to RTW Rewind. I have a very, very special guest. I mean, this show is all about retro wrestling. And this gentleman has seen it all, done it all. Had a very, very long career and a very good career in the world of professional wrestling. You will know him as one half of the WWF tag team, the Killer Bees, with B. Brian Blair. He is the other half. He is the one and the only Jumpin' Jim Brunzel. Good afternoon, Jim. Thanks for having here. Thanks for being here, and I appreciate you taking time out and speaking with me today.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate the opportunity. It's always fun to talk old wrestling, you know.
You know, I have to ask, do you still follow the product, or do you watch any wrestling? No, I get a lot.
No,
I get that a lot.
I don't want to criticize too much, but it's changed so radically from when there used to be 26 territories, I was fortunate enough to work for Vince for about 8 years, and he fired me 3 times. So it was sort of there was no love-hate relationship. It was sort of a hate-hate relationship. So, I watch it today occasionally, and I think the best thing about it is the boys are making the most money they've ever made.
Yeah.
And, they're still independent contractors. So I think that's the biggest plus of what's going on today.
You know, and they do make very good money. But, you know, back in the day in the 80s, you know, you hit the WWF at the right time. I mean, if you were on those Hulk Hogan cards, brother, I'm sure you're getting pretty good paydays.
Well, he was a golden goose, you know.
And, right, yeah. Everybody wanted to work the A show, right?
Yeah, well, and it's funny because I remember when Brian and I first started, and this is the way it worked in the WWF then, now WWE, when they brought new guys in. And you know, you worked. Brian and I worked for the first 3.5 years. We averaged 27 days a month.
Wow.
On the road.
Yeah.
We went 52 days in a row without a day off. Then I broke, Greg Valentine broke my hand in Rockford, Illinois. So I was home for 2 days, and they put a cast on my hand, and I won more matches with the clothesline than I did with the dropkick for about four weeks.
Nice. Nice. You didn't milk it like Bob Orton did for those many years.
But, no. No,
that poor guy, man. You know, his arm never healed. I'll tell you.
He was one of the best talents of my era by far. He was his timing. You know, there's a few guys. His son is probably the best in the WWE for timing and what he does. But yeah. You know, there was guys like Jake Roberts and him and Ricky Steamboat, and then you get to the older guys. You know, it's funny. I was looking online and it happened to come up, and it said the 20 greatest wrestlers of all time. And out of that 20, maybe 3 of them should have been in there.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's, yeah. Yeah, I think it was written by the WWE too.
So. Probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, speaking of guys like Hulk Hogan, you know, people don't think he was actually a great wrestler, but you know, I've said this on my show a couple of times. If you go and look at some clips that are on YouTube of Hogan wrestling, you know, Keiji Muda out in Japan or guys like that. Hogan could work. I mean, Hogan knew how to wrestle. He didn't have to.
Yeah, that's right.
He didn't have to.
Very good. You know, in Japan, it's totally different. And I remember him when he first got big over there. I mean, geez, he was incredible. And he worked for Inuki, and I worked for All Japan, Baba. Mm-hmm. And Baba had big stars, Stan Hansen, Frank, you know, Goodish, Bruiser Brody. Yeah. And Hulk was, you know, I was leaving and he was, you know, he was incredible. And he, you know, for a big guy like that, you know, 6'7" and 300 pounds, you're right. He could work very well.
Yeah. I mean, he could chain wrestle. He could submission wrestle. He could. But when he got to WWF, he didn't. There's no reason why he had. I mean, he just had to, you know, he could sell the whole match and then, you know, Hulk up and, you know,
that's it, baby.
Punches, boot, big leg, game over. We're getting paid. That's all he had to do. And people loved it. I mean, people give John Cena the same kind of thing, but that's all they have to do to get over. You know,
Well, Hulk, you know, I remember I still have the Sports Illustrated, Rob, that said the number one banana in professional sports was Hulk Hogan. He made $10 million in 1985.
Wow.
And I remember, you know, when we were there, he was, and the royalties were big. He was making $50,000 a week just on royalties. And then he was getting $1 million, you know, per pay-per-view. And they didn't have that many, but, oh, man, he was just, it was unbelievable. And Brian and I got to travel with him a couple times, you know, in the Learjet and everything. It was really cool. He spoiled the hell out of us, you know.
That's cool. Now, did you like him personally? Was he a good guy?
Yeah. Well, when he was in, he came to Minneapolis in, I think it was 82, 83. He was only here for about a year. And they brought him in as a heel, and they had John Sullivan, you know, the, what's John, what'd they go as? Johnny and Jimmy. I can't think of the name, but they were a tag team. And John Sullivan had come out there and he'd do these heel interviews. But the people fell in love with Hulk. And it really sort of perturbed Vern Gagne. You know, Vern was the All-American wrestler, you know, four-time Big Ten champ, two-time national champ. And, you know, he'd been a world champion off and on for years. And then all of a sudden Hulk Hogan comes, big blonde-haired muscle guy, big guitar, and just – set records all over. It was incredible. I mean, he was just, he couldn't go anywhere in Minneapolis or St. Paul. He was just a phenomenon. And then, you know, when he left, because he loved Minnesota, because he only had to work about 10 times a month, you know,
right.
And he could work out. And, you know, I got to tell you a quick story. I had him over to my house. He came in and I says, you know, I says, you know, I'd like to have you over for dinner. So I think we had, you know, something nice like a steak and lobster. And he was downstairs with my son, who was about 3 years old then. And my daughter was like five, and they were both down there. And I brought down some hors d'oeuvres, some crackers and cheese.
Yeah.
So I was upstairs grilling and everything. And I came down and Hulk was sitting on the couch and my son, Jimmy, who was three, was sitting on his lap and he had this bowl of cheese and Hulk's mouth was completely full of cheese. And Hulk says to me, Jimmy, he says, tell your son I don't want any more cheese. My face was just full, you know. But, you know, I hated to see him go, but he just set the AWA on fire. He was incredible, and you know, it just kept going.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people don't remember that Hulkamania started in the AWA with Vern before he even got to the WWF. So and when by the time he got to WWF, you know, that was his second run, because obviously his first run was cut short because he wanted to be in Rocky III, and Vince Senior said, "No, brother, no, nope." So you know, Hulk did the movie. Obviously, you know, people knew him from that movie. So when he got back to AWA, yeah, it was just a natural thing to turn him babyface, right? I mean, he was very charismatic.
Well, Vern wanted him to be a heel, and the people accepted him as a babyface, and so the legend began.
Right, the rest is history, yeah.
Tired of the PC police telling you what you can and cannot say? Want a show that travels back to the 80s and 90s, where the badass hosts have beaten down cancel culture on three separate occasions and carried on to gloat about it? Since 2013, The Midnight Jury is that show. Travel back to the malls and arcades, pop in your VHS, and join us where the 80s and 90s return from the dead. Conan, tell them where to find us.
WLWstudios.com, home of the Midnight Jury podcast hosted by Midnight Mike and Calvin Brody.
Also available on all major podcast platforms via the Shining Wizards Network, and join in the conversation on Twitter at Midnight Jury.
RTW Rewind.
Let's start a little bit with your early life. Did you? I always ask this question to just get a gauge of if you're a wrestling fan or not. Did you grow up watching wrestling? I know Minnesota was a hotbed for that, but did you grow up a wrestling fan as a kid?
You know what? My mom and dad wouldn't let me watch it. You know, they were they were Lawrence Welk fans, and I remember down in Memphis. My dad was in the Navy as a pilot, so he was all over. We lived all over. I lived for a year in the Kwajalein, which is an atoll out in the Marshall Islands back in 1956 or 57. And in 58, we moved to Memphis, Tennessee, and I watched the wrestling there, and they had a hell of a feud between Sputnik Monroe and a guy named Billy Wicks. Well, it's funny because Billy Wicks was from St. Paul. I'd watched in Sputnik. I don't know if he, you might not remember him, but he had a silver streak down the middle of his hair. And it's funny because Sputnik Monroe came to the Mid-Atlantic to referee when he shit. He had to be about, he had to be close to 70 then.
Yeah.
And he was refereeing one of my matches. And as he was, you know, going through everything, I says, Sputnik Monroe, Billy Wicks, 1958, Tennessee, and he looked at me like that and walked away, you know, but that was my real first exposure to wrestling, and, you know, was Memphis, Tennessee, because my folks wouldn't let me watch it. And then when I, the whole deal with wrestling, me getting involved was, I went to the University of Minnesota as a walk-on freshman on the football team. Greg Gagne, I was a wideout, a split end, and Greg was a walk-on too, Vern's son, and he was a quarterback. So we became, you know, good friends and actually did well together, you know, combination. And I remember Greg inviting me over to his house, and Vern had the coaching staff from the Vikings there, and they lived there. They had a beautiful $2-3 million house right on Lake Minnetonka, the biggest lake in the Twin Cities. Beautiful walk out. Oh, it was just gorgeous. So Vern had hired this Hank Meadows, who was the galloping gourmet cook, and he had cooked. He had this great big burner going, and he had, I swear, Rob, there were little fillets like that. There must have been 40 of them on there. So, and I was a big meat eater at, you know, young age.
Yeah.
So Vern walked up to me and he says, Jim, he says, you have as many as you want of those. And I bet I had six of them, you know. Great. But that was my first introduction to Vern, you know, and, you know, that life. And I thought, geez, this guy's got it pretty good. You know, little did I know that, you know, you know, at 17, I never thought I'd have a 25-year career in pro wrestling. So.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, well, yeah, you're obviously a football guy, you know, and when that didn't work out, you know, you went into wrestling. I mean, there's countless and countless stories of the boys that were football guys and who never even had any plans of wrestling, ended up getting hurt, getting injured, or you know, whatever reason didn't work out, and they turned to wrestling, and especially in Minnesota.
So,
I know you're a little bit before, you know, guys like Kurt Hennig and Rick Rude and all that. They were a little bit younger than you, but I was just talking to Nikita Koloff the other day. I had him on the show, and the class that he was in was phenomenal. Seven guys that went to school together in Robbinsdale ended up getting into business, and all of them became pretty much Hall of Famers. Minnesota was just an amazing breeding ground for athletes and wrestlers.
Well, it was because, and I think, you know, there was 26 territories for the longest time, and and Vern had a, he had a great territory, and guys just like coming there. And Vern made it, you know, he was predominantly wanting to have wrestling matches, not so much, you know, just kicking and punching, but wrestling and work off that and tell stories. And those guys, I mean, Larry Henning, you know, and not, you know, they had three generations, Kurt and then his son,
Yep.
So Joe, who just got let go. But, it was a hotbed. I mean, there was, like you say, a number of guys, you know. I mean, you look at my class in 72, it was Kim Patera,
yep.
Osro Waziri,
yep.
Bob Bruggers, who broke his back in a plane crash, Ric Flair, mm-hmm. Greg, and myself. I mean, you know, it was all of us did real well.
Yeah, well, I think Rick did okay.
Oh, yeah.
I think,
a bit either.
Yeah, no kidding. That's what I've heard. But you know, yeah, Vern was really big into, you know, amateur wrestling, obviously, and helping out the kids and going to schools and scouting people and all that. And, you know, he liked shooting. He liked the treats, you know, he liked amateur wrestling. And, he didn't, you know, watching some of his older stuff, he didn't have the glitz and glamour really until, you know, the tail end and all that. But, you know, when you watched AWA, you watched, quote, you know, real wrestling. I mean, it's always a work, but you know, it was more of a hard hitting grappling kind of stuff and not as much high flying and glitz and glamour that you saw when you got the WWF. But I don't think Vern gets enough credit, you know, for being such a successful promoter and a businessman, just based on the fact that he would just never change his ways. I mean, I think that's why he got a little bit of a bad rap, because he just couldn't change with the times.
Well, all the other promoters were jealous of him, really, because you know, he was a bona fide champ.
Yep.
And he was a great worker and a very successful promoter, and a lot of people didn't like that, you know. And sort of, you know, he had a way of, you know, all those guys had huge egos, and you know, a lot of guys didn't like that about him. But, you know, you can't argue with the success he had.
Yeah, no, that's right. You know, getting back to Hogan for a second, leaving the AWA, we've all heard the story of him coming back into town and supposedly Vern, you know, I think there's a story that maybe Iron Sheik was going to break his legs when they fought. Is that...
Oh,
did you hear that story? Or
that I heard that, but I think that was just, I think just that,
just a tale to be told.
Yeah. I do. And to be honest with you, I know, you know, Cosgrove was a great amateur wrestler, but he, you know, in a street fight, it's pretty hard, you know, if a guy pokes you in the eye and grabs you by the throat to suplex a guy.
That's true.
You're going to be in a state of shock.
You know? Yeah. So. Yeah, for sure. Who trained you in antivis? Was it Vern?
Well, actually, Billy Robinson, who was
okay.
Empire champion, who was incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, he was smooth and he had a horrible reputation for hurting people.
Mm.
And, you know, he could do anything in the ring. He could make the worst person in the world look like one of the great wrestlers of the day, or he could do just the opposite. He can make one of the greatest wrestlers. I remember they put him with Bob Orton Jr. and Bobby was got it. Like I said, Bobby was, he was in the top three of my era. I mean, he was incredible in the ring, and Billy Robinson just guzzled him and ate him up. And I felt so bad. And you know, Billy had that reputation. And, you know, I just felt sorry for Billy, because a lot of people didn't like him. And to be honest with you, it was pretty hard to like him, because he was egocentric because of his success, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he was his own guy, and he did train us, though. I mean, Vern, you know, sponsored us, and then Vern had come in maybe – you know, our camp was 6 days a week, and I think it was 4 to 6 hours a day. It was rough. And Billy just, you know, he'd submit and he'd tear you up and do all this stuff. And then Vern, after you'd been there 2 hours, then Vern would jump on you, you know, and say, okay, get out, you know, and he'd be, your tongue would be down to about here, you know.
The stories like that Ric Flair tells are true. I mean, he obviously quit and came back because he couldn't take the tremendous cardio stuff that Vern and them were making you do. I mean, was it that bad? You know, like 1,000 Hindu squats and
1,000 sets of 100. And honest to God, I had, you know, I could always jump, but after that training, that you know, we started off doing a couple sets of 100. You know, we'd start off doing a set of 50 and then doing another set of 50. Then pretty soon, I mean, we were doing 10 sets of 100 every day, you know, and my legs ballooned up, you know. And yeah. I mean, we all, I mean, the stamina that it gave you and the leg strength was unbelievable. But it was, you know, I mean, they made us run and then we did all this bridging. And then the bad thing about it was that Billy would, you know, do the submission holds. And, you know, when it hurts, you tap him on the arm, you know, and then he'd hold it for another 10 seconds.
Yeah.
So you'd be, geez, please, you know. Yeah.
But I mean, that's how it was back then. They were obviously testing you guys to see if you had what it, you know, had what it took. And a lot of guys quit. But, you know, guys like yourself and Rick and the successful guys were the ones that were tough enough to stick it out. And that's what they were looking for. They were looking for guys that they could keep and that they could use, you know, and not, you know, leave and leave them hanging. So obviously things aren't done that way anymore, as far as I know.
No.
You know, things are a little bit different now with, you know, especially like WWE Performance Center. It's a very controlled environment. But, you know, there's not many old school guys left that came from that generation and know what it's like to break into business that way and to pay your dues, you know, hit the territories, hit the road. You know, guys, as far as I know, you know, a lot of them don't drink anymore. So, you know, business used to be done back in the bars, you know, back in the day. And you learn a lot, you know, driving with the vets, you know, and you sit under the learning tree. And unfortunately, business isn't done that way anymore. And the product kind of shows for it.
Well, I have no idea how the guys are today. You know, I've met a couple of them. I went and saw Hulk and I saw Rick when Rick was making an appearance at the Target Center in Minneapolis, and Hulk was there. Oh, it must have been 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And just to make an appearance, et cetera. And, you know, I'd see the guys there and everything was, so, you know, I mean, they're all real muscular and, you know, I have no idea about their athletic backgrounds. And to me, here's my whole philosophy about what Vince looks like or looks for in the WWE. If you are muscular and have any ability to speak, you have a good chance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God rest his soul, Jim Heltwig, you know, the Ultimate Warrior. I mean, he was a licensed chiropractor, and he couldn't work a lick, really. Couldn't work a lick.
Yeah.
And he couldn't really do interviews. And, you know, he'd go into the ring and he'd grab the rope and he made so damn much money and he was so much. I remember the first time I saw him, Hulk was on the card and we were in LA and get out of the car and cars and wherever we were, I think it was a sports place down there. And there's this kid standing on the side and he had a tank top on and he was just huge. I mean, his lats were just hanging. And I looked at him, I said, holy Jesus, you know. And it turned out to be Jim Heltwig, you know. Yeah. And, you know, he made a ton of money. And, you know, it's too bad. You know, Cripe, he died so damn early. But, you know, he was a nice guy, but he just couldn't work.
Yeah.
You know, and his interview, I mean, he got pushed so hard. I remember, this is the truth, Rob. He had a match with Andre the Giant, and I believe it was Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And he beat Andre in about 15 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And with, you know, 3 or 4 clotheslines.
Yeah.
And I don't think they ever went back there for, you know, it's working because it killed the town.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, ay. But, you know.
And unfortunately, they made that loop. I actually saw that same match. I grew up in Connecticut originally. My wife is from Tennessee, so I moved here about 10 years ago. But originally growing up in Connecticut in the Northeast, you know, I was able to go to Hartford, New Haven. I was able to go to Madison Square Garden and all that. And, you know, I watched that match a couple times. I watched it in Hartford, and then I had the MSG Network, and the same exact thing happened. That's when I knew wrestling was a work. As a 13-year-old kid, when I went to Hartford and watched Andre fight Warrior, and then 3 days later, I watched the same exact move-for-move match on the MSG Network, and my dad still holds that over me every day. You know, he says, remember when you first learned the wrestling was fake? And I said, yeah, Dad, I know. Yeah, you're right. Like 3-4 clotheslines. I think he even slammed them and then, you know, gave him the big splash and boom, that was it. And Andre, who had been, you know, such a larger than life guy for so many years. And obviously he wasn't in good condition at that point in his life.
Hey, this is Jason Powell from ProWrestling.net, the Rad Turtles Wrestling Podcast. It's amazing to me that turtles have the ability to speak, let alone host wrestling podcasts. I guess that's what makes them rad.
RTW Rewind.
How much of a professional is Andre? I mean, because if he didn't want to put you over, he didn't have to. You know what I mean? He didn't have to let Jim put him over like that.
Well, I'll tell you,
put him over.
Listen to this. Here's another cockeyed finish. He was wrestling Nick Bockwinkel, and I think it was in Iowa. And they did an hour draw.
Wow.
An hour draw. And poor Andre had found out that the finish was going to be an hour. So he got a big bottle of vodka. I mean, a big one, 1.75 liter. Drank the whole damn thing before the match. And he passed out in the ring at the end, and he had Nick in a headlock, and they couldn't separate him. And we had to carry him out and put him in the shower. Mm-hmm. And he laid flat on his back in the shower for half an hour. And it took six of us to get him upright and dried up and get him into the car. I mean, and you know what? They never went back to that town either.
That's hilarious. Oh, man. You know, and God, whoever would have booked Andre to go an hour anyway?
Oh,
know,
Broadway, my God. I mean, that was real strange, you know, because I couldn't see that coming, you know.
But, I mean, younger Andre could go, though.
Sure. Yeah, he was such a wonderful guy. And, you know, it was so hard to be a giant. And mm-hmm. I could tell you a real quick story about me driving Andre. This is when he was in the AWA, and we were wrestling in Peoria, Illinois. So after the match, there was a battle royal, and Peoria to Moline was about 99 miles. And he had this girl coming in, his girlfriend, and he had some beautiful girlfriends that he kept and, you know, took mm-hmm. care of him and gave him beautiful stuff. And so we're leaving Peoria, and he says, stop at the liquor store. So we stop at the liquor store, and he got a 12-pack of beer. So I'm driving down the road, and he's sitting next to me. And we're going, and I got a Cadillac. We're going down the road, and all of a sudden, I see this cop with his lights on going south, and I'm going north. And all of a sudden, he pulls right across the median, boom, he stops me. So I give him my license, and he says, you know why I – stopped you. And I said, I probably was speeding. And he says, yeah, you were. And I said, well, I'm trying to get my friend here. He has to catch a plane to go to New York in Moline. And he says, well, give me your license. And then he looked at Andre, and Andre had this bag between his legs. And the officer said, what's in the bag? And Andre says, beer. And he says, what? And Andre says, beer. So he said to Andre, get out of the car. So Andre gets out of the car, and all of a sudden the cop stands back, and he's so he looks in the bag, and out of the 12-pack, we've only gone 10 miles. He drank 7 beers. In,
wow.
10 miles. And so the cop looked, and he counted the empties, and he said to me, have you been drinking? I said, no, sir, I got a Pepsi. So the cop says, okay, open up the trunk, put the rest of the beer in there. Shut it, got back in the car, and he gave me a ticket. I think it was $105 for speeding. He didn't give me an open bottle. So we're driving down the road, maybe 25 miles, and all of a sudden Andre looks at me, and he says, Jimmy. I said, yes, boss. And he says, pull over. And I said, what for? He says, I want the rest of the beer. But we did make it back for, you know, the rendezvous for his girl. But, you know, he was a wonderful guy. And it's hard to be a Giant.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, to be that big and you know, I heard stories of him, you know, breaking beds and cars were so small for him and hard to get in the shower. I mean, yeah, it is. It was really hard to be a guy that big, especially near the end of his career when he got a lot heavier, you know, and he's 300, 400, 500 pounds. Yeah. Yeah. You got to feel for the guy. And, you know, it's funny if they would have ever found out what was wrong with him, what caused that growth in his head. He obviously, you know, he would have had a lot longer life, but,
you know, well, you know, this is the truth, Rob, too. He drank 3 bottles of Merlot before he went in the ring every night. 3 bottles.
No kidding. Yeah.
And he'd sip them like they were water, you know, cribbage. All of a sudden they say, Andre, you're up next. And he'd sit there with his tights on. He goes, whoa. And he'd pull his tights on and that was it. Wet from the wine and walked out.
I love him. I love hearing old stories like that I never heard before. I love hearing the stories of him just messing with guys like the Ultimate Warrior, you know, when Warrior got a little stiff with him one night and Andre put him in his place, or, you know, messing with Jake the Snake and stepping on his hair and pulling on his arms. I mean, it's just, you know, like there's so many stories where he'd fart on somebody, you know, when he like a you know, a scissor hold or something. Like just he loved to rib people.
He used to have this Halliburton bag. Everybody used to have these metal bags that carried their, you know, the wrestling gear in. So Andre had his bag and he had a couple of bumper stickers on it. One of the bumper stickers said, "Don't get too close or I'll fart." And he'd open up in front of him as he walked off the plane. So the people would see that, you know, pretty funny. He's a good guy.
That's great. I mean, you know, you got to wrestle some of the greatest wrestlers in the history of the business. I mean, you came in at such a great time. I mean, people refer to the 80s as the golden age of wrestling. And, you know, you saw the who's who when Vince cleared up all the territories and took all the top guys. You know, when you got to WWF with Brian, you got to wrestling the best guys in the world. You know what I mean? It's just, it had to be incredible to have so many, to work with so many great people in the ring.
Well, I was very fortunate because, you know, during that era, there was a group of guys that were, you know, heading towards the end of their career, especially in the AWA, you know, and also in the NWA, you know, guys like Nick Bockwinkel, Vern Gagne, Billy Robinson, Jack Briscoe, Terry Funk, Dory Funk. I mean, these guys were incredible. And then you throw in Ricky Steamboat, Flair, and Jake Roberts. I mean, there was some incredible talent, and I and Harley Race. You know, I did 3 1-hour draws with Harley. I did 3 1-hour draws with Flair, and I did 3 with Nick Bockwinkel.
Wow!
And the hardest Broadway I ever did was with Khosrow Vaziri in Roanoke, Virginia. And I'll tell you the premise. I was a Mid-Atlantic champion. Khosrow was there as a heel, and he had this loaded boot. So the referee was pushing me back for something, I don't know, and he loaded the boot, boop, kicked me in the chin, covered me 1, 2, 3. So next week we're wrestling on TV. I wound up putting a sleeper hold on him and beating him, taking off his shoe, and I'm holding his shoe, and I, you know, showing, oh, it's heavy or something, you know. So they had a match coming up the next week in Roanoke. So I'm wearing his shoe. So, you know, everybody says, well, you know, I mean, it was the main event for the Mid-Atlantic title. So I get there and Sandy Scott, who's the brother of George Scott, who was the booker, said, "Did you get the finish?" And I says, "No." And he says, "Well, George wants you to do a Broadway." I said, "What?" He says, "Yeah, he wants you to go 1 hour through." I said, "Sandy, I said, why don't you just dig a hole in the ring in the middle of Roanoke and throw me in there?" I said, "Because I'll be dead and Kelsey's nuts after this, because I can't beat him normally, and let alone not having his boot on. I mean, what's the difference?" I mean, and George Scott was horrible as a booker. I mean, he was a nice guy. You know, he came from Canada. He wrestled in the AWA. He had enormous success in Charlotte, because he had such great talent there. I mean, Viper and Jack Mulligan and Ric Flair and Steamboat, and they were just incredible. But he was a horrible booker. God rest his soul.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I mean, I've heard stories about him, and you know, he had a pretty good run, you know, in certain territories as the booker. I think he was even, booking WWF at one point.
He was there for the matter of fact, he fired me in the Mid-Atlantic. And the reason why is because during that same stretch with Cosro, I was wrestling him in a small little town. And I think it was some small town, and there was it was unbelievable population of North Carolina indigenous Indians. Ooh. So there, and we were main event, and they wanted me to go an hour again with them, spot show. So I said, okay, so we're in the match, and all of a sudden, about 25, 30 minutes into the match, Cosmo says, oh, my back is hurt. I said, is your back really hurt? He said, yeah. So wound up having him get disqualified. So the next day, I get a call from the office, and George Scott says, Jim, I want you to come in and talk to me. So I go in there and talk to him, and he says, why'd you change the finish? I said, well, because Cosro hurt his back. And he says, I talked to Cosro, and he said, no, he didn't. Hmm. So he fired me.
Wow. Well, that I'm sure that took you aback a little bit.
Well, I couldn't wait to leave there. I mean, they worked every single day, even though you were home every night, but they worked every single day, and sometimes twice on Saturday and twice on Sunday. Mm-hmm. You made money. The weather was incredible, but you had no family life. You couldn't do nothing. And my kids were young, and, you know, we eked it out. I was there, I don't know, 14 months, and I went to Atlanta for a little bit, and then couldn't wait to get home.
Yeah. Well, that's unfortunate, but, you know, at least you had other places to work. I mean, nowadays, it's not that easy. I mean, you could go, you know, learn your craft from so many different guys and so many different promoters over the years. But right now, I mean, there's only, you know, 10, 15 places other than indies to work, you know, 4 or 5 really good places to work compared to the old days. It's obviously different now, but that's.
I thought there was only 2 places to work.
Well, yeah, I mean,
three count in Japan.
I hate to put,
because the indies, you know, there's 3 indie shows here, and then, you know, they draw 200-300 people, but, you know, and then they bring in guys, you know, to sign autographs, and then they pay these guys more money than they take in.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that. Yeah. But yeah, that's another story for another day.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's your boy, the coach from the WWE. 20 years, 2 decades in the greatest business that the world has ever seen, pro wrestling. Now, there are very few wrestling podcasts out there that I like, but this one I love. I love the name. I love the personalities. I love the content. The Rad Turtles Wrestling Podcast, that's where you're at right here. Follow. Subscribe. I do. Enjoy the show. I'm the coach. Till next time. Roll it.
RTW Rewind.
When you left the AWA, how did you get into the WWF? Who made that? Did you make that call, or did somebody recruit you, or how'd that work?
Well, Terry Hogan and I were real good friends, and here's the situation, Rob. I had, you know, Minneapolis was losing, the AWA was losing a lot of talent. I mean, Gino Kernlin left, Bobby Heenan left, Jesse left, you name it. So, you know, that the houses weren't drawing very well. And I, at this time, 1982, I opened up my own gym called Jumping Jim Brunzel's Gym. And it was a co-ed gym. It was small. It was only about 5,000 square feet. And I had X amount of, you know, weights. And I had a real nice steam bath and a hot tub and sun tanning beds. And I needed X amount of dollars to supplement this business. Things were getting bad, and I went to Vern, and I asked him, I said, Vern, I said, I realize the situation's bad here, but I said, I have a business to run too, and I said, you know, the towns are bad, and I said, I need to have a guaranteed contract, you know, with you for me to stay here. So he says, how much do you want? And I said, 95 grand a year. And, you know, he looked at me, and he said, you're not worth it. Go.
Wow.
That's what he said to me.
No kidding.
Yeah. So that same night I called Hulk and I started, I think, June 25th, 1985 in Poughkeepsie for TV. And the first guy I met on the small plane, we flew into LaGuardia and then had a commuter plane. First guy I met was Hillbilly Jim. Of course.
Super nice guy from what I've heard.
We talked to each other. I'm going to talk to him tonight. Rob about once a month, and you know, he wonderful guy, big guy, and he really did a great job selling the, you know, the Hillbilly deal, you know, it was, you know, I when I saw what I was getting into at in Poughkeepsie, I thought, oh boy, here we go, you know, but. You know, and then they, you know, they made Brian and I the Killer Bees, and we actually, you know, we had a good run, even though we were, you know, frustrated because we were told that we were going to get the belts, you know, a couple different times, and it just never happened. And to be honest with you, Vince didn't like me, and he didn't like Brian. So I remember the first time when I'm in Poughkeepsie. You know, they interview me and, you know, I'm a straight baby face. There's nothing there for me to, you know, talk about, and I'm not a character. So after the interview, I'm walking off and I hear Vince say to somebody else, he says, oh my God, we got another Backlund.
Oh God.
That's what he said. And I thought, oh boy, that's a good way to start.
Yeah. But, and Bobby was his top guy for how many years, right?
Oh, but Bob, Vince Jr. didn't like Bobby. Yeah. He just didn't like, he didn't like the idea of a, you know, wrestler being the world champion. And, you know, and Bobby's a wonderful guy. And I, you know, he worked his, you know, his heart out.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. And we see, he was born either a day before me or a day after me. We're both.
No kidding. I didn't know that. Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty cool. And actually, I mean, he was really a Vince senior guy. I mean, when Junior took over, you know, obviously, you know, Hulk Hogan took over and guys, the wrestlers weren't the top guys anymore. But that's funny that you mentioned we got another Backlund. That's pretty funny. I never heard that before.
well, I'm sure Bob wouldn't like to hear that.
But yeah, probably not. Yeah.
When I heard that, I thought, oh boy. And then, you know, right away we had, you know, some ongoing litigation. And it just didn't work out very well. I had some dolls that were being made from LGN, and they were High Flyer dolls. And I didn't sign the contract, so they were made, and $12,500, which was a upfront bonus that we got for signing with this LGN. Vince took the money, you know, I was under contract with him. So I thought, geez. I said, you know, so I talked to my lawyer and he says, he can't take your money. He says, that's your money. So we sued him and we got money. And this was in the first 3 weeks that I worked for him. You know, so I knew I had about two or three pins stuck in my voodoo doll right then.
Yeah, no kidding. And for those of you listening that don't know, Jim and Greg Gagne were a tag team called the High Flyers. So, you know, obviously those dolls were made before you got to WWF. Exactly. And since you signed a contract with them, I'm shocked that Vince even thought he can get away with that.
You know, there's been a multitude of talent that have sued him.
Yeah.
You know, Brian and I wound up suing him because of a little clause in our original contract that we had with him. Said we were going to get X amount of, you know, the royalties off outside stuff, not stuff that was pertinent to the WWF at that time. Well, wound up, he only paid us 8% of the net instead of 25% of the gross. So we were owed a lot of money. So, you know, but at that time we did settle out of court. And the only bad thing was that, at least Brian considers this bad, is that we forfeited the rest of our royalties, which would probably be about $125 in the last 20 years.
You know, it's funny that, you know, you had such, I wouldn't say a long run, but I mean, you had a good run. You had about, what, a 6-7 year run there? And
I had 3 years with Brian, and then they fired us. And then
You came back in 88, yeah. I think, 89, somewhere around there?
Yes, yeah, 88, and then I worked all the way to 93.
Yeah.
They, you know, it's me, and I needed the money, you know, so I had to do some jobs, which, you know, everybody has to do, but I was disappointed in the way, you know, that he did this. And although I had some good matches, you know, I had a good TV match with Randy Savage that was really good. And then I had some matches on the road that were good. But, you know, it's just the fact that he wanted to, you know, really put his thumb in my eye, you know, which, you know.
I mean, back then, I mean, I know it's your job, but did wins and losses mean to you? Mean anything to you? Because, you know, some guys say yes, some guys say no.
No.
Obviously, you want to get pushed and you want to make more money, but I mean, you're still doing your job.
Well, you can make more money off a loss if the loss is done right.
Right.
The loss should increase a story that projects onto the future where you make more money. Yeah. Sure, if the guy beats you 1-2-3 in the middle of the ring, you know, with a baby face move, you're dead. You know, yeah. Yeah. But you know, it was funny because Vince didn't like he didn't like any skullduggery. He didn't like anybody cheating. He didn't want anybody to show any weakness. You know, and that was the big deal about a baby face and a heel. You know, they always say, you know, what the difference between a baby face is. And you'd say, what? And they said, a baby face takes two steps forward and a heel takes two steps backward. You know, so yeah. It's easy, you know, and the people react.
Yep. Nope. You're absolutely right. I mean,
everything's the same now, Rob.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know who's a baby face. There's no baby face. There's no heel. They're all wrong, you know, and they're all, you know, and everything. I'll never forget Bobby, who I consider the greatest talent of my era all the way around. I mean, he was brilliant in the ring. He was a great, great interviewer, and he was an incredible manager. And I remember him being so frustrated because Bobby only had an eighth grade education. So when he was there at the end, they were giving him pages to memorize his interviews. And he says, Jimmy, I can't do this. He says, I got to ad lib. And that was the end of him because the same thing with Hulk. I saw Hulk and he was Mr. Santa Claus at this December show that I saw him at Target Center in Minneapolis. And he must have had about this. And he says, Jesus Christ, you know, he had to memorize everything. I said, God, I couldn't do that.
I couldn't either. And, you know, back in the day, you either could talk or you couldn't. And the guys that could talk usually made more money.
Exactly.
And the guys that couldn't, you know, end up getting jobbed out. But yeah, I mean, you know, you look at guys like Roddy Piper. You really think if Roddy, you know, Roddy was still around now and he was on TV, do you think he would go off a script?
Yeah, I'm sure probably they would raise some heck about it too, because, you know, Vince's writers now are, you know, they more or less run the show. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because when I went to Gene Okerlund's funeral last year, I sat and talked with the guy who'd worked with TV. I can't remember his name, but you know, they talked about the whole thing in terms of, you know, every being, you know, it's a real soap opera. I mean, it's just, you know, and to me, just watching when I was there and watching what's, you know, transpired in the last, you know, 20 years, there's no real stories. There's no continuity between one man in a town. I remember, you know, I know because Vince has so many towns to choose from, but I remember, you know, in the old school, you'd have a town like Winnipeg, you just in Winnipeg and you'd build off that and you might have three or four matches in the following months in Winnipeg and build. Cripe. In the WWE, they'll have somebody wrestle in San Francisco, and then the next card there, none of those guys will be on the next card.
Yeah, I know. It's and even their TV, I mean, there's so much 50-50 booking where, you know, no one's going on winning streak. You don't have undefeated guys like Kurt was, you know, back in the day and stuff like that. It's and you're right. It would be between there's no real distinction between heel and babyface anymore, because even the heels are cool. I mean, even, you know, the smart fans love the heels now. And, you know, you don't have any real dastardly guys, you know, like you used to back in the day. And exactly. It's a lost art. Psychology in wrestling is a lost art. It's now more about the performance and about being a showman and being a great athlete than really telling a story. And I have to watch it every week and review it for the show. So, you know, I come from the old school era. I grew up in the 80s and have to watch the product now and try to not be so hypercritical and try to suspend my disbelief. It's a hard thing to do nowadays with what I see.
Well, I had heard that what they're trying to do, the WWE is trying to project a program and that is really taken in by kids because they want the wrestling to become more like the games.
Right.
Because the kids are such gamers now, so they want this action, you know, to be like a doggone game that you can play on, you know, on your laptop or your whatever they play those games on now.
Right.
My grandsons are playing them all the time, Fortnite and whatever else it is.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, no, you're right about that. And like I mentioned earlier, with business being done in the bars, you know, the new generation now, business is done playing video games backstage. I mean, there's a lot of guys nowadays, the newer generation, that's gamers, and that's how they bond. You know what I mean? And it's just funny how, you know, different generations do business, you know, different ways. But I there's still some things I like nowadays. You know, I like Mike Rotunda's kid, Bray Wyatt.
Yes.
It's fantastic. Like he is, that guy, he's a character. He's, mm-hmm. he's one of the few true gimmicks left. And he's so good. I mean, every promo he does is so good. And he knows his character so well. And, you know, guys like him will get over.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Well, guys that got talent and have personality and shape that to what they need to bring, you know, to bring the fans out, you know, they're going to do it. You know, yeah. That same way with the young Orton kid.
Yeah.
You know, he's, whoa.
Yeah. No, Randy's great. And Randy, you know, and by all accounts, people say he's better than his dad and he's better than his grandfather. And there's some truth to that. But it's obviously a different style now than when.
Oh, than without when
his
a dad, doubt.
You know, he's
without a doubt. Yeah. I wrestled his dad too.
Did you?
Yeah. And, well, not only Bobby, but Big Bob.
Okay. Bob Sr.
Yeah, in Kansas City when I and he used to look in the mirror and he used to go like this. He says, "You think if I took a little tuck here I'd look 5 years younger?" Laugh, you know.
Man, you want to talk about a family lineage, man. To have that much talent and, you know, like even the Hennigs and the right. Funks and, you know, the Von Erichs. I mean, like there's been some pretty successful families in the history of wrestling.
What's going on, everybody? My name is Vampiro. This right here is the Rad Turtles Wrestling Podcast. Tune in, get tuned up, get informed, and enjoy the podcast.
RTW Rewind.
How are you able to achieve that longevity where some of your, you know, many of your brothers are no longer here?
That's the sad thing, really. And I think a lot of it, you know, was a crutch. And, you know, like just like society throughout the last, you know, three decades, you know, alcohol, drugs have played a huge part in society and they're so prevalent. And, you know, if you're on the road, you know, for 20 days a month, you're away from your family, you don't like being away, you know, and you try to retreat and, you know, what's ever there, it happens. And then eventually, if you're not grounded right, and there's, you know, there are a lot of guys that were grounded, you know, that realize that this is just a business and don't get too carried away and made it through, you know. But you're right. There was so many guys and I saw, oh, geez, I saw so many guys that just, you know, they ruined their lives, you know. Yeah. And most of it was the drug use, you know, And I think what happened in the 80s that because Vince liked the muscular athlete. All the guys, you know, everybody was using steroids. Everybody was.
Yeah.
And then at the same time they were using steroids, they were drinking. They were doing uppers and cocaine, and they were smoking, and they were taking sleeping pills and pain pills.
Yeah. So
you put all that together, you know, it's you're just, you know, you're lucky if you survive that. And, you know, finally they Vince realized that he had to do something. So he started drug testing. And I think that helped instill in the guys, you know, hey, you know, you got to clean up or you got to be careful, you know, or tone down. You know.
Yeah. I mean, obviously he went through the steroid trial, you know, in the 90s, and, you know, obviously
he's still using something now. Have you ever noticed how pointed his head got? He looks like he could be, you know, back in the 18. Yeah. Oh, my wife said, be nice. But I just noticed that his head is sort of looking like an ape's head.
I didn't realize that. Now that I'm going to see him, that's all I'm going to see now.
Well, I hope not.
But yeah, no, to be, you know, almost 80 years old, I think he is. And to be
73.
Is he 73? Okay.
Yeah, he's 2 years older than me.
To be that jacked? I don't know. You know, I.
Well, it's not that he doesn't have enough money, you know. I mean.
Well, yeah, sure, for sure.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because you listen to The Rock, and I met Dwayne when he was 17. He was going to go to college, and we met him in, I think, Miami, and really a nice guy, and, you know, could see that he was, you know, good athlete and had a lot of stuff. But now you read what he does. He's got hires a chef to cook some 5 meals a day, you know, small meals.
Yeah.
And you know, all you have to do is open your mouth and chew. I mean, you know, it's not like us when we used to have to go and, you know, boil, you know, a dozen eggs and bring them on the road, or, you know, get a steak and hold on. I remember Billy Graham, superstar Billy Graham, when he was with the AWA, and he was incredible.
Yeah.
So they were doing interviews, and we were just starting, and we were just watching interviews. And I saw him over on the side, and he had this great big plate. And Rob, I swear, he had about a 3-pound porterhouse on there.
Wow.
He was just nibbling at it all day long. Yeah. You know?
That's hilarious. Yeah, I mean, I've heard stories of guys going and getting, like, you know, 30 chicken breasts and stuff like that, and just, you know, just pounding protein and all that, because you're working out so much, and you're you know, you're working 30 minutes a night or 20 minutes a night, and you go, you know, hit the road and drive for 3-4 hours and hit, you know, check in, hit the hotel the next day and go the same cycle. But, you know, you got to keep fueling your body. And yeah, you're right. Dwayne does that. And he'll post his cheat days on Twitter or Instagram, and the amount of food that he consumes on his cheat days, I think I'd be in a coma.
I mean, it's amazing.
It's amazing how much he has to eat to keep up with his workout schedule. He's working out 3-4 times a day, and he's a, you know, he's a 45-year-old guy or so.
Well, I mean, he's got for people that really like to work out. I mean, he's got the best job in the world. I mean, you know what they make? I heard he made $154 million in the last 3 years.
Man,
you know, he's one of the highest paid actors, if not the highest paid actor.
I think he is the highest
paid actor. Yeah, more power to him. I mean, congratulations. He, you know, best of both worlds.
He puts the work in, though. I mean, you got to give him credit. His work ethic is pretty solid, and he does put the time in. And yeah, I mean, to go to have that kind of success when, you know, guys like Piper, guys like Hogan, guys like Jesse all tried to do the Hollywood thing back in the day, and they never, man, can you imagine if they ever reached the heights that The Rock has reached? It's pretty incredible what he's able to accomplish.
Yeah, he's one in a million, really.
Yeah.
You know, he's very fortunate, and I just hope he's happy. I'm sure he is.
Yeah, I hope he is too. You know, you were at WrestleMania 3, and obviously we know that was the largest crowd that Vince pretty much ever had. Were you able to take in any of that the day of the event and just realize the magnitude of not just the event, but how many people were actually in the building when you're out there wrestling, you know, Sheik and Volkov?
Well, I saw the crowd, and we had done some interviews, and I'm trying to remember who Aretha Franklin. was there, and she sang the national anthem, and I saw her in the corner, and there was a lot of, you know, celebrities there, and I remember all the different news people. I mean, there was news people from Japan and Europe and Australia, and it was incredible. And Rob, to be honest with you, we were supposed to be on like second or third. Mm-hmm. They made us on right before Hulk and Andre. And so the people really, you know, by that time were just waiting, you know, and then the finish of our match was really something that was set up to set Jim Duggan to become a big star, you know, because he came in and, you know, whacked, I can't remember I think he whacked Khosrow with the 2x4. And here's another finish. Now we were happy that we got disqualified. You know, Pat, Jim Duggan on the back say, "Oh, thank you for help." And I thought, I said to Brian, I said, "Geez, can you believe that?" You know, and he said, "Well, just don't say anything." You know, but you know, it was a big thrill. And I remember we had a number of deals before that, you know, the little press meetings, and we were talking to people, and they had a party afterwards, and Hulk had a big suite, and there was about five couples up there, and they had food and everything, and then they had a band and everything, and then actually I had some friends from my area, White Bear Lake in Minnesota, that were big real estate people, and they successful real estate, and they asked me, you know, if they could, you know, get tickets and come along. So we, you know, we had like four other people with us, and I was, you know, my wife had known, you know, some of the other wives of the wrestlers, and it was pretty chaotic, but you know, it was fun. We got paid $10,000, and we got paid, I think, 6 weeks later. Wow. And rumor was that Vince had stuck the $100 million that he'd made in a 6 month note and collected the interest and then paid the boys. But I don't know if it's true, but I just want to pass that on to you.
Wow. I never heard but that.
Yeah. I think Hulk and Andre got $1 million apiece. And then mm-hmm. I think, you know, some guys got 25,000, and I think there was a couple guys that might've got 50. And actually, you know, 10 grand's a lot for one night, but when you think of how much money.
Well, look at the gate. There's 93,000 people there, man.
Yeah, well, that, and just think what the pay-per-view was.
That too, yeah, because pay-per-view had just started right then. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, in the closed circuits and all. Yeah, no, I hear you. That's I mean, yeah, it is a good payoff, but considering how much money that he took in.
Well, you know, he's a billionaire.
No, I mean, there's a reason why.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, there's a reason why.
Yeah. Oh, I got a quick little line to tell you. I heard today, I have a friend at work, and he's a huge wrestling fan, and he gets all the scuttle and everything. And, you know, Vince bankrupted the XFL a second time. Yeah. And I heard the rumor that he was going to buy it back next year. And the reason why he went bankrupt is so he wouldn't have to pay the coaches and the players.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. It really wouldn't.
No, I wouldn't. No.
Yeah, I mean, he's true.
That's being real true.
Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I just wanted to reinforce that he is a billionaire.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And obviously your relationship wasn't that great with him, but I mean, why do you think he kept you around for so long?
Because he could use me. Mm-hmm. You know, the young Hart boy who tragically died.
Owen, yeah.
Owen, yeah. He got hurt, so they brought me in to take his spot for a little bit, and then somebody else got hurt. So, you know, here's the deal. You know, I was working part-time, but I was making like 50 grand working part-time, which is, you know, you can't do that working full-time, you know.
Yeah,
So it worked out good. You know, it worked out good. And then it was funny because I the last show I did, a signing show, it was March 6th, 7th, and 8th, and we were in Queens, Long Island, and Albany, right before the virus had really taken over. And I think his name's Mr. Hughes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Was sitting right next to me. And when he came in, I worked with him on one of the very first Raws at the Manhattan Center, wherever it was.
Yeah.
And I put him over. And I wanted to say, you know who was the first match you ever had in the WWE? And you know, I put you over, but I didn't say it. But we were all there, and we had all of our hand sanitizers and masks and everything, and everybody was elbowing. And
right, yeah.
But it was you know who was there? Undertaker, and yeah. He got $120,000 for 3 hours.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's pretty good work for a guy, you know.
Yeah, and then Bret Hart was there the next day up in Albany, and he got $15,000.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good to see Brett. I hadn't seen Brett, and Brett was a hell of a worker. He and I had two or three 30-minute draws. One was in the Garden, one was in the Spectrum in Philly.
Yeah.
Oh God, we had a hell of a match. And I like working with him because he was solid, and you know, he did that same sort of style that I grew up with, and you know, a good guy. His partner, though, was impossible to work with, Jim Neidhart.
Really? No kidding.
Oh, God. He was like a rhino. You know, he was 5'9 and 270 and completely out of his mind, God rest his soul. But it was really hard to work with in the ring.
I didn't know that. Yeah. And I mean, everybody loves Brett. I mean, nobody has a real bad word to say about him. I mean, you want to talk about someone whose work looks so good and so believable.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he
was stiff. You know, yeah. I like working stiff with, and yeah, he was really good. And another guy who I hadn't seen in a long time was Jake Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think the world of him, and I'm glad he's, you know, cleaned up himself a little bit and lived a little longer, because he was on a real, you know, he was on that path that wasn't very good. But, you know, I made a 10-day trip with him.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted me to drive because he knew that I wasn't going to get drunk and smash up or drive off a cliff.
Right.
We started in Northern California, and 10 days later we were in Phoenix, Arizona, and we had the best of the time together. He was a real character. He was something, but what a worker. Oh God, was he.
And he's another guy that less is more. He didn't have to do a lot in the ring, but
yeah,
absolutely. I mean, number one, he could talk people in the buildings with his promos, yep. And he had such a unique style of talking low and getting, you know, drawing you in instead of screaming and hollering like the muscle heads and all that. But
yeah,
and then to just, I mean, he was over. He knew psychology of the business, and that's
yeah.
And he's working today in AEW, and he's helping out some of the younger guys still. So
is he?
Yeah,
well,
he is.
I know he was doing a nightclub show.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
I missed him in Minneapolis, but you know, I gave him a big hug when I saw him in Albany, and I gave him my card. I says, you know, give me a call. He probably threw the card away, but it was just good, so good seeing him. You know, I know we're gonna get being close to being the end here, but I wanted to show my book. Yes, can you grab me that Madlands book? I think there's one around the corner there. This Madlands was fun. You know, it took me 5 years putting this thing together. And, you know, we'd go out to people's houses and have dinner and everything. And I'd normally talk about, you know, wrestling stories. And they said, you should write a book. I don't know if the people can see that.
Yep.
But that's it. That's me. I was sitting on a chair on a porch in the Marshall Islands on the island, atoll called Kwajalein. And here's the backside. This picture was actually taken yesterday.
No. I can tell. Yeah, you haven't changed a bit.
and then we have these comic books that were made. This one here is the second copy.
Yeah, I heard you and Brian had a comic series out.
Yeah, they're cool. Sort of fun. I mean, you know, how many people have a comic book? But this Matlands was really fun to do. And I have a great, I didn't know if you knew this or not, but I'm a huge Bruce Springsteen fanatic.
Yeah, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I happened to meet Bruce and in 1984, and now, sure enough, I won't be able to find the damn thing. But Mary and I have seen him maybe 80 times.
Wow, no kidding. There you go.
That was in the Meadowlands with my daughter and son. And then this one here was in Chicago. I don't know if you can see.
Yeah, that. I can see it. That's cool.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I mean, back then, he was at the height of his popularity.
Oh, you know? God, and he's such a nice guy. He's incredible. Yeah. And this was the first night that I met him in the opening, let's see. Where?
There you go.
Yeah, that was at the opening tour, the night of Born in the USA in 1984 in St. Paul. And I waited until about 2:30 in the morning backstage. And he comes out, and he was so nice, and he's, I can't say enough good about him. He's just an incredible person.
That's pretty cool. And that's great that you got to meet him and become friends with him.
How many people get to meet their idol?
That's true, yeah.
I feel very blessed on that end of it.
It's pretty cool. You obviously weren't on Hulk Hogan level, but, you still had a really, really good career, and anybody that watched wrestling back when I did still know who you are. And, you were at WrestleMania 3. And to consider, Bruce Springsteen one of your idols when you're considered a celebrity yourself back in the day, it's just funny how we always, you don't always see yourself being as big as you are, right? You know what I'm trying to say? And
yeah.
The fact
it's funny because I still get mail all the time from, people want me to sign cards, and then I still get recognized. I was on TV for, 20 some years. So, yeah. It's nice when people come up to you, and then that probably the worst thing is at a bar, if you're at a bar and then somebody comes up to you and they sort of look at you and and they say, I know you. And then I say, you must have met me in prison in 19 Stillwater, and then they walk away. So
that's hilarious. But I grew up as a wrestling fan as a kid, and when I saw you and Brian on TV with the cool tights, the Killer Bees gimmick and all that, and I thought you guys were great, and I never forgot that stuff. Even 30 something years later, I saw you on LinkedIn. I'm like, wow, I'll just take a shot and connect.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you did. The Killer Bees, we had a very unique gimmick that no babyface team ever used because it was a heel deal. And, they could have gone so far with it, and I'll never forget this. We were wrestling in Lake Placid, and it was an 8-man tag. And listen to this. It was Coco Beware, George Animal Steel, and Brian and I against, I can't remember the Hearts and somebody else. But at the end of the match, all four of us had our masks on. And Coco was dancing. And George was trying to, he had the mask on crooked, and he was trying to bite the dog on turnpost.
Right.
And I was looking at Brian. And I says, Brian, I think the Killer Bees are done right now. And we were, too. I don't think we had a match after that.
That's funny. Yeah, there's so many more stories I can get in with you. There's a lot of things I didn't get to touch on, but I would like to do this again in the future if you'd be willing to come back in a couple months.
Well, sure. I enjoyed it, Robbie. Very easy, pleasant. It was easy.
All right, Jim. Thanks for coming on, man. I really appreciate you taking time, and I'll talk to you later.
Peace, and good health.
Thanks, buddy.
See you. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to this episode. You can follow RTW on Twitter at Rad Turtles Pod, and you can email the show at RadTurtlesWrestling@gmail.com. We appreciate all of your support. You've been listening to RTW Rewind, exclusively here on the R&R Podcast Network.